Now, violence, of course, comes in a huge range of forms, doesn't it? There's the gratuitous, perverted violence of the video nasties. And there is the disciplined, professional violence of the armed forces. There is the violence of a domestic row, and there's the violence of a mafia blood feud. There's the violence of the school playground, and there's the violence of the headmaster's cane. There is criminal violence, and there is police violence. There is the violence of the iron fist, and the violence of the velvet glove. There are those, of course, who in their blanket commitment to pacifism refuse to distinguish between these various categories of violence. Driller killer and the parachute regiment are all one to them. Nazi gas chambers and toy guns all fall under the same ban. So let me make it clear right at the outset, lest anyone should misinterpret the title of our study this morning, that that is not a position I would want to defend. When I speak of an alternative to violence, I'm not trying to suggest that all forms of violence are wrong or unnecessary. Now, I'm referring there to one very particular kind of violence, namely the use of violence as a means of achieving political change. Revolutionary violence, if you like. Now, it seems to me there are four good reasons for us spending time this Sunday morning looking at that issue. The first is this, surprising as it may seem to some. Our church comes from a very revolutionary tradition. You see, Eden belongs to the English Calvinistic independent tradition from the 17th century. That's where our church roots lie. And that being so, we have an illustrious spiritual forefather who contributed more than his fair share to the growth of revolutionary consciousness, Oliver Cromwell. His military overthrow of the Stuarts, perhaps more important than that, the intellectual defence of that action that was provided by his supporters, men like John Milton, for instance, that was arguably the seed out of which, well, first the American War of Independence, then the French Revolution, and finally Karl Marx himself and the Communist Manifesto. All that grew, you could argue, from the Puritans and their desire for freedom. So if we would boast of our Puritan roots, we must also take a measure of responsibility for the proliferation of violent revolution in the last 300 years, which the Puritans were at least catalysts of. That's one good reason why we, particularly, ought to be aware of this subject and have thoughts on it. The second reason is this. In recent years, Christians, especially in some parts of the Third World, have once again become prominent spokesmen for violent revolution. I'm thinking of the so-called liberation theologies of Latin America and South Africa. Now, Christians of this persuasion are seeking today to integrate the gospel with a Marxist analysis of society. And they want to say that revolutionary violence can be a dimension of Christian salvation. That's the word they want to use of it. So at the Bangkok Assembly of the World Council of Churches back in the 70s, this view was expressed in their published documents. Salvation includes the peace of the people of Vietnam, independence for Angola, justice and reconciliation in Northern Ireland, and release from the captivity of power in the North Atlantic community. And one American delegate at that conference went so far as to say, Chairman Mao was God's Messiah for the Chinese. Now, this highly politicized theology is becoming very influential in some parts of the world. In Latin America today, Christians are participating in acts of violence against the state in the name of Christ. So it seems imperative that we have some clear ideas what we think about that, especially seeing as we now have missionaries working in theological education in Colombia, where inevitably that issue is a major cause of debate. Then there's a third reason for looking at this subject, an alternative to violence, and that's this. Because in recent years, it seems to me we have seen a frightening growth in the use of violence as a political tool in our own country. Sometimes, as in Northern Ireland, it's been a carefully planned campaign by ideologically motivated extremists. Sometimes, as in the Brixton riots, it's been a spontaneous boiling over of frustration and anger within a local community. But no matter whether it's been thought out or not, there's no doubt in my mind that people generally are more sympathetic to the use of violence in political action than they used to be. In spite of all our long-standing tradition of conservatism in British politics, the idea is getting around, particularly among the young, that violent action is the only way to get things changed. And if we're honest, they're not short of evidence to cite in support of that. Just take Toxteth as an example. Had you ever heard of that place? Were you in the slightest interested about its problems until those riots last year? But within a month of that civil unrest, Michael Heseltine was down there touring the place in an open-top Land Rover and surrounded by huge media coverage, was introducing all his rich businessman friends. The message which many read from that incident is that violence works. It's a dangerous message. And of course, it's not only the left that are getting that message either. I don't know if you've ever heard of the phone call that was made on one of these radio programs, phone-in radio programs in San Francisco on KGO Radio. "Violence has no place in America," said the caller. "Anyone who preaches violence should be shot like a dog." So the right wing as well as the left may think that violence works. But fourthly, and most importantly this morning, the reason we've got to look at this subject of revolutionary violence is because the story of David, which we've been studying in recent weeks, raises this question of revolutionary violence in a very direct and obvious way. You know, one of the reasons I personally find it such a challenge to go through a book of the Bible systematically in the way we do on Sunday mornings is that it forces us to look at questions like this. There's an attitude you'll sometimes find in Christian churches, and particularly in evangelical churches, that really politics is something that should be kept out of the pulpit. The preacher's job is just to talk about the forgiveness of sins and eternal life and things like that. But you see, if you read the Bible as a whole, instead of just selecting out the odd favourite text here or there, then political questions of this sort just slap you in the face. You can't avoid them. Take this story of David just as an example. Here is a young man who, through the prophet Samuel, has received a divine commission to be king. His growing popularity at court and with the people have provoked the insane jealousy of the incumbent monarch, Saul. And the result is that David has been forced to flee for his life into the mountains. Such is his personal charisma, however, that we read in chapter 22, verse 2 of 1 Samuel, "When he'd gone into the hills there, all those in distress or debt or discontented gathered round David, and he became the leader of about 400 men. So almost without effort on David's part, he's become the captain of an outlaw band, a ready-made guerrilla army. The only one thing really stood between him and the fulfillment of his political destiny, and that was the overthrow of Saul. David knew he had the military genius to achieve that goal by force, if he'd wanted to. And now all these malcontents flooding to him were providing him with the manpower to do that. It was an open invitation to the use of revolutionary violence. And yet what I want you to notice this morning is that David resolutely refused to accept that invitation to violence. Tempting as it must have been for him, he would not seize the crown that way. And in that policy of non-aggression towards his enemy, David, I believe, sets us an example of enormous relevance to our contemporary world. It wasn't understood that David was a pacifist. On the contrary, he was totally convinced that there was a legitimate use for force against Philistine giants, for instance. But warrior though he was, he would not become an assassin. When it came to the achievement of internal political change, he insisted upon an alternative to violence. And I want to suggest to you that the main purpose of chapters 21 to 26, which we're going to look at today, is to show us how David learned that lesson. We'll study it in three parts under the three headings that you'll find on the bulletin. First, the advantage of divine guidance in chapters 21 to 23. Then the reliability of divine providence in chapter 25. And then finally, the fear of divine judgment in chapter 24 and chapter 26. Let's start with the advantage of divine guidance. And this brings us to the very tragic story of the priests of Nob. Look at chapter 21, the first few verses. David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a certain matter and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I've told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me five loaves of bread or whatever you can find.'" Now this picks up the story where we left it last week. David is a solitary fugitive, desperate for help and particularly in need of provisions and arms. This story he tells to allay Ahimelech's uncertainty is, of course, a downright lie. He didn't have any men at this time, and the king had certainly not sent him on any mission. It may be said, I suppose, in David's defense, that he probably told the lie in order to avoid putting the priest in the compromising position of being a knowing collaborator with a wanted man. But if that was his goal, then the ploy failed to protect Ahimelech, for unfortunately Saul had his supporters even at the sacred shrine of Nob. Look at verse 7. Saul said to them, verse 7 of chapter 21. "Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg, the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd." Now what this sinister fellow was doing lurking around the sanctuary isn't clear. Detained before the Lord could mean anything from recovering from a contagious illness to having a short holiday. But whatever the reasons for his presence, the consequences of his opportunist espionage were to turn out to be quite horrifying, as you'll see. Having persuaded Ahimelech to give him food and the only weapon in the place, which ironically was Goliath's sword, no doubt on view at the shrine as a kind of trophy, David goes off to find safety and eventually to link up with his brigade of renegades in the hills. But in the meanwhile, Saul has discovered David's escape and has started an inquisition, cross-examining the local people to find out who had assisted him. So we go to chapter 22, verse 6. "Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul, spear in hand, was seated under the tamarisk tree on the hill at Gibeah with all his officials standing round him. Saul said to them, 'Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you've all conspired against me?'" In other words, "Look, all you lot belong to the tribe of Benjamin, don't you? Well, if this upstart David becomes king, it's no good thinking he's going to give you feudal grants of land and army commissions. They're all going to go to his own kinsmen in Judah. So if you're taking his side in this business in the hope he'll reward you for your support, he's pulled the wool over your eyes. Come on now, out with the truth. It was Jonathan, wasn't it, my son? He was the traitor. He was the one who enabled to make his getaway." It may be that Doeg had some personal reason for wanting to divert blame from Jonathan. Be that as it may, it was at this critical moment that he chose to step forward and chip in his five pennyworth of amateur detective work. Verse 9. "But Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, 'I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath, the Philistine.'" Now, what follows must be regarded, I think, as one of the most terrible atrocities recounted in the Old Testament. There's no incident in the whole story that demonstrates more powerfully the brutal and ruthless way in which Saul's psychopathic jealousy had gripped him. Ahimelech is summoned to answer these charges, and naturally he protests his innocence. "Your Majesty," he said, "David is a highly regarded commander and your personal bodyguard. Why shouldn't I have trusted him? I've helped him on dozens of occasions in the past, and there's never been any question of disloyalty raised. How could I know that he was on the run? But Saul is not interested in Ahimelech's pleas of ignorance. Verse 16. The king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family." To their credit, Saul's own guards perceive the injustice of this situation, and they refuse to commit this cold-blooded murder of unarmed clergymen. But Doeg suffered from no such moral scruples. In an instant, he's promoted from being king's informer to king's executioner. Verse 18. The king ordered Doeg, "You turn and strike down the priests." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. Nor was he content with that. His bloodlust wasn't sated till he'd conducted a vicious pogrom against the entire city. Verse 19. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys and sheep. A quite disgraceful slaughter, making many of the most notorious massacres of history look like Sunday school picnics by comparison. But what I want you to notice from this story is the effect it had on David when the news of it reached him. Look at verses 20 to 23. But Abiathar, a son of Ahimelech, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And then David said to Abiathar, "That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, 'I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who is seeking your life is seeking mine also. You will be safe with me.'" Now there are two things I want you to notice from that. The first is David's feelings of guilt. "I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family," he says. Now, David had been involved in bloodshed before. He'd killed plenty of men in battle. But this was the very first time he'd been involved in murder. And it's quite clear the awfulness of that crime made a profound impact on him. It's a terrible thing to have the violent death of good and innocent men on your conscience. If David hadn't known that before, he knew it now. And a man who has learned that lesson will think twice before he takes up arms in pursuit of his own political ambitions, you see. Of course, we never intend that innocent people shall perish in the crossfire of our conflict, but they always do. And insofar as we're responsible for that situation of violence in which they are caught, we, like David, have their blood on our hands. "I am responsible for the death of your family." The second thing I want you to notice is Saul's bad luck as a result of this incident. Look at verse 23. "Stay with me. Don't be afraid. You'll be safe with me," said David. See, ironically, from now on, for all of Saul's dogged pursuit of David, David will never come to harm. Do you know why? Because he has a priest of the Lord at his side to guide him to safety. That's the recurrent message of chapter 23 that follows on here. Just look at verse 1 and verse 4 of 23. Do you notice? David was told, "Look, the Philistines are fighting." He inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack them?" Verse 4, once again David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, "Go down to Keilah." Now what does it mean, David inquired of the Lord? How did he get that specific direction to his questions? Well, the answer is in verse 6 of chapter 23. Now Abiathar, son of Ahimelech, had brought the ephod down with him when he fled to David at Keilah. Now this ephod, you see, contains some means of divining God's will. We don't know exactly how it worked. It was probably some kind of sacred lot, which was cast to give an answer yes or no. But the vital thing about it was that it was part of the high priest's paraphernalia, what's called the ephod. And only a priest could use it. So you see what the result of Saul's murderous revenge on Ahimelech and his clan was. Instead of giving Saul an advantage in his campaign against David, it merely served to drive into David's arms the only man left in the entire country with the means of discerning God's will in this supernatural way. And David wasn't slow to make use of it. Look at verse 9 of chapter 23. When David learned that Saul was plotting against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod." See, this would be the repeated story. From now on, with this divine oracle as David's ally, Saul could do no more than chase blindly and hopelessly after him, only to find that David, as if by magic, has been warned of his approach and has escaped in advance. Saul's violence against the priests has backfired on him, you see. And that lesson surely could not have been lost on one as intelligent as David was. Oh, I've no doubt the terrorist techniques that Saul employed at Nob produced results. They generated fear, they quelled support for David, maybe, they intimidated the masses. But a wise man calculates not only what his policies achieve, but what they forfeit. And if by an arbitrary and an unjust use of violence we alienate good men, holy men, spiritual men from our cause, if by such violence we close the ears of God to our prayers, then whatever political advantages that violence may secure, it's utterly outweighed by the loss of moral and spiritual support which it costs us. You see? So tempting as violence may be to the would-be revolutionary, when you compute the long-term consequences of it, you may well find on balance it's counterproductive to your interests. Saul would have discovered that if he thought about it more carefully. David learned it by observing what happened as a result of Saul's massacre. And it's a lesson David did well to learn early. There are some, I suspect, in the IRA today who could do well with learning it today. Finding an alternative to violence has political advantages. That's the first lesson I suggest to you David learned within this context of revolutionary violence. The second, the reliability of divine providence. And this brings us to the rather charming story of Abigail that you'll find in chapter 25. Look at verses 4 to 8 of 1 Samuel 25. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. So he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, 'Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that's yours. Now I hear that it's sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants and they will tell you. Therefore, be favourable toward my young men. Since we come at a festive time, please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them." This is a reasonable request, you see, for a Christmas box. Nabal was an extraordinarily wealthy man. We read in verse 2, he had thousands of goats and sheep. And charity was a very important virtue in Israelite culture. Indeed, at festival times, it was a legal obligation under Mosaic law to share your produce with the needy. What's more, as David points out, his militia had demonstrated commendable restraint in not bullying Nabal's staff or plundering his flock during the time they'd been living around there. In fact, as the shepherds themselves testify, if you look on to verse 16, the presence of David's private army had actually provided a most welcome protection against sheep rustlers in the district. So in one sense, they had earned some reward from Nabal's table. All ways round, David was justified in expecting a cordial and generous response as he sends his young men to knock on the door and hold out their hand to Nabal, especially because he told them to express their request in such courteous and gracious terms. But instead, however, Nabal lived up to his name. The Hebrew word Nabal, you know, means fool. And that's precisely what he proved to be. Verse 3 says he was surly and mean in his dealings, and that seems to put it mildly. Because not only did he refuse to give David's men any provisions, he was downright rude into the bargain. Look at verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse?
Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I've slaughtered from my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? You get the idea of it, don't you? Well, David's response was understandably indignant. He was a hot-blooded fellow, you see, who enjoyed a good fight at the best of times. And this fellow Nabal had really irritated him. Look at verse 13. David said to his men, "Put on your swords." And just see it, can't you? It's like a scene out of West Side Story. "Come on, lads, get your flick knives out. We're going to teach this toffee-nosed peasant some manners." David was a very tough customer, you know. I hope you realize that. A very different sort of fellow from that sentimentalized shepherd lad image we sometimes have of him. I tell you, if he'd gone to Grange Hill, I suspect Tucker would have more than met his match. Look at verse 21. "It's been useless," David said, "all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He's paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." Those of you who have more ancient versions will be aware that David uses rather cruder language to express the representatives of Nabal's family there. See, David was not the sort of fellow in whose face you kicked sand on the beach. Not if you wanted to live to tell the tale, that is. But on this occasion, this is the interesting part of the story, his wrath was placated. And perhaps we are not totally surprised to discover that it was a woman who did it. Verse 14, "One of the servants told Nabal's wife, Abigail." Now, who could ever accuse the Bible of male chauvinism with heroines like Abigail adorning its pages? According to verse 3, Abigail was a most remarkable lady. She had two outstanding qualities, each of which on its own would have appealed to David, but which, when found in tandem, proved to be a quite irresistible combination. She was beautiful, and she was also intelligent. And as for the latter quality, why, her speech leaves us in no doubt about that. Look at verse 23. "When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before him with her face to the ground and said, 'My lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He's just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent. Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my master be given to the men who follow you.'" Now, David wasn't short on the gift of the gab himself. But even he was bewitched by this stunning rhetoric, especially as it came in such an attractive package. Who could say no? She twists him round her little finger. And so you see in verse 35, David accepted from her hand what she had brought from him and said, "Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." Well, as I say, it's a charming story and intended to be an entertaining one, I think. But the sacred historian has not included it just for the sake of entertainment. It contains a vital lesson related to this theme of violence. And you'll find it in the sting in the tail of Abigail's eloquent apology in verse 31. "My master will not have on his conscience," she says, "the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself." And as if to drive home the import of those words, the narrator has David echo them in verse 33. "May you be blessed for your good judgment, Abigail, and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands." Many people, you know, read the Sermon on the Mount, that bit about turning the other cheek, and they jump to the conclusion that this is some new ethic of non-violence which Jesus is propounding there. Never heard before. You know, I seriously question whether that's so. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, when he says turn the other cheek, is simply reaffirming a principle that you can find throughout the whole Bible. And that is this: that vengeance is God's sole prerogative. No permission is ever given anywhere in the Bible for an individual to take revenge for injuries done to him personally. True, there is a verse in Exodus 21 which has often led people to think to the contrary. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, it says. But if you read that verse in its original context carefully, you will find it is not, as indeed some of the scribes in Jesus' day were pretending, an instruction to the individual citizen to take revenge on his enemy. No, it isn't that at all. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in Mosaic law is a piece of guidance to the judiciary on how to fix penalties for condemned criminals. It's not an incentive to personal vengeance at all. It outlaws it by vesting retribution in the courts. And it's quite clear from what David says here that he realizes all this. It's familiar to him. Abigail's words sober him up. What he was contemplating doing to Nabal was utterly illegal and immoral. He had no right to avenge this insult with his own hands. It was for God to deal with men like Nabal, not David. And the point of the story is that that is exactly how it turned out. Look at verse 36. When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. You get an eloquent picture of this stat, don't you? He was in high spirits and very drunk. So she told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him and he became like stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Do you see what I mean by the reliability of divine providence? Centuries later, Paul would express this matter with great clarity for the Christians at Rome. He would say, "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord.'" How clearly David had learned the wisdom of that with the benefit of hindsight. Look at verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept me from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head." And as you will see from the end of verse 39, David, as a result, not only got Nabal's provisions, he also got his widow. So the humiliation of this boorish Scrooge could not have been more complete. And it was achieved not by the violence that an impetuous, hot-headed David had planned, but by the providence a sovereign, just God had planned. I say again, a man of David's intelligence would not have failed to learn the lesson of all that. Violence is so often born of our irrational anger. Oh, we attribute it to our righteous indignation. But is it not so that our violence is often simply a case of wounded pride, as was David's towards Nabal? Again, violence is so often out of all proportion to the provocation. It's of the nature of violence to exaggerate. Nabal had been rude and mean, okay, but is that sufficient grounds for taking his life? Yet such was David's intention in the heat of his rage. It's often that way. Again, violence is so often an expression of ill-considered haste. David had only to wait, and God himself would bring the sin of this foolish man down upon his own head. But so often in our fury, we lack such patience. But most of all, violence is so often motivated by thoughts of revenge. And whatever way you look at it, vengeance is morally indefensible. Whatever injury we may have suffered, if we take the law into our own hands, all we do is to incur guilt ourselves and frustrate that retributive providence which God himself might well have enacted on our behalf if only we had left room for his wrath to operate. instead of our own. And I say many, many people nursing grievances and plotting deeds of cruelty today, just as David did, who need to learn this lesson. An alternative to violence is not only advantageous to us, it will often be more effective for us because we live in a moral universe and there is a providence at work bringing proud sinners to naught. And that brings us to the third lesson that David learned in regard to this question of violence, the fear of judgment. And it brings us back to this chapter we read together before we started our study. Chapter 26. The fear of judgment. Look at verses 8 to 11 of this chapter. Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As sure as the Lord lives, the Lord himself will strike him." Now, some of you probably noticed that there are two occasions recorded in 1 Samuel when David has an opportunity like this to kill Saul. One is back in chapter 24. That's an incident which I always think has a touch of the Carry On films about it. You know, David and his men are hiding in a cave, and Saul comes marching by, and feeling a call of nature, he decides to go into the privacy of the cave to relieve himself. And while he's there, with his trousers down, as we would say, David cuts the corner of his robe off in the dark. It was probably a symbolic act, as well as a cheeky one, because his robe may well have been part of his royal insignia. Anyway, David later on parades his prize after Saul has left the cave, all unaware that his underpants are rather overexposed. Now, this incident is rather similar, but a little bit less carry-on-like. In this case, David and Abishai actually invade Saul's camp by stealth. And David steals a spear and a water jug from beside Saul's bed, once again to prove how totally he had had his adversary at his mercy. Most scholars put the so-called duplicate narratives down to the fact that there are two literary traditions that have been blended together. And not a few would argue that they are garbled accounts of the same incident. Personally, I think that grossly underestimates the intelligence of the narrator. Not to say the truthfulness of the Holy Spirit who's inspiring him in this book. Now, the reason the author records these two accounts of David's sparing of Saul's life, I suggest, is the same as the reason for recording two accounts of David's arrival at Saul's court earlier on in the story. Do you remember? He wants to show us how divine providence and human skill are blended together in David's success. In chapter 24, David is just lucky. Saul happens into the cave by coincidence. It's an act of God, as we would say. In chapter 26, David has to work for his chance with great bravery and skill. So by setting the stories in parallel like this, the author is tacitly making his point. David had the advantage over Saul in both these ways. He didn't spare his rival out of lack of God-given opportunity. Providence gave him unmistakable opportunity. Neither did he spare his rival out of lack of personal courage, for David demonstrated enormous personal courage against Saul. Now, his sparing of Saul was due to something else, and both in chapter 24 and here in chapter 6, we find the clue to his reluctance in the words he speaks about the situation. Look at 26 verse 9. David says to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" So it was not from the fear of Saul's bodyguard that he restrained his arm, but from the fear of God's judgment. There was a moral issue involved. Who can do it, he says, and be guiltless? Now that seems to me to have some vital things to teach us in relation to this question of revolutionary violence. The first thing I want you to notice about it is David's respect for the person of the king. You see what he calls him? The Lord's anointed. And later on, repeatedly, "My Lord the King." It wasn't just the sanctity of life then that restrained David from this murder. It was regard for the God-appointed nature of civil authority. He is the Lord's anointed. Now that's significant. Do you remember I said at the beginning that it was the Puritans who were amongst the first to ever seek to justify a violent revolution in modern history? Now it's most interesting to note the rationale they used in defense of their revolutions. One of their commonest arguments was this, that an existing government forfeits its legitimacy by acting in a tyrannical manner. When governments behave in an unconstitutional way, they said, their divine mandate was no longer upheld, and then they could be resisted by force. That's one of the arguments of John Milton. It's also the argument of the Huguenot rebels. It became very important in John Locke's great treatise on government, some of you may know. Now, speaking personally, I have to say I have some sympathy with that point of view. And yet, at the same time, the story of David has to give us pause. You see, if ever there was a regime that had forfeited its divine mandate, it was Saul's, wasn't it? We're told distinctly God had rejected him as king over Israel. David had been anointed in his place. If ever there was a just revolution, it was David's. The crown was his by divine right. And yet we find, in spite of the validity of his claim to the throne, David is repeatedly referring to Saul as the Lord's anointed, words that accord him enormous honour as due to the sovereign. As far as David is concerned, you see, while Saul is in power, he's still the king. And only God has the power to unmake that situation. It's an example to us that even governments whose legitimacy we doubt must be accorded respect. The apostle in the New Testament, speaking of Caesar's empire, says, "The authorities that exist have been established by God. There's no authority except that which God has established." And any would-be violent revolutionary had better weigh those words carefully, as David did. The second thing I want you to notice from David's fear of judgment here is the political use which he later made of his non-violent stand. Look at verse 24. "As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble," he says. Now, I have to be a little careful here, but you know, what David is doing in this rhetoric which he engages in between Saul and himself, between the hillsides, after the incident, what David is doing there, in this public manner, pointing out his leniency towards Saul, is not unlike some of the tactics of a man like Gandhi or of Martin Luther King, say. Now, I know it's possible to accuse these great 20th century pacifist politicians of moral blackmail. Gandhi, for instance, undoubtedly exploited the Christian moral conscience of the West. If it had been Russia he'd been dealing with instead of Britain, India would have suffered the same fate as Hungary and Czechoslovakia. We mustn't be naive about that. Equally, it's true that there are certain kinds of so-called passive resistance and non-violent protest which are every bit as coercive in their own way as if the person was putting a gun to your head. IRA hunger strikes, suffragette suicides and the like, these are all emotional levers intended to manipulate people by guilt. David is certainly not encouraging us in that kind of technique. But undoubtedly he is here seeking a political advantage over Saul by exposing his record of non-violence to public gaze and appealing to Saul and the others. You see, he says, "I am a man of peace. You started this fight, not me. And I could have won it if I'd wanted to by violent means, but I've chosen not to do so." Verse 18, "Why is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What wrong am I guilty of?" Important to realize, you see, that even though our enemy may be a godless man, it doesn't mean he has no conscience. All men made in the image of God have consciences. They have an intuitive sense of right and wrong. All men acknowledge that the slaying of innocent people is a crime. And nobody likes to have such crimes laid at their doors, especially in public. It doesn't look good in the newspapers. That's why Western journalists and the Catholic Church are so important to Polish solidarity, isn't it? It is their defense against brutal suppression, a moral defense. Now, I'm not defending moral blackmail, but David seems to demonstrate here that the diplomatic advantage of being a non-aggressor in a situation is there to be used and exploited. Once we turn to violence, we no longer have right on our side in that obvious way. And any experienced politician knows that moral superiority is just as important as military superiority in the world of diplomacy. That's something else that's worth noting in this whole area of revolutionary violence and alternative to it. But the thing preeminently I want you to notice in this incident in chapter 26 is the sensitivity David has in regard to his political methods, if we can call them that. Look at verse 10. The Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now you see, Abishai was one of those, like Marx, Lenin, Stalin, who believed that the end justified the means. He as good as says so in verse 8. God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Let me pin him into the ground. I won't have to hit him twice, you know. In other words, surely God doesn't intend you to pass up a chance like this, David. You're the real king in Israel. Everybody knows that. Killing Saul and crowning you in his place would be the best thing that ever happened to the country. We would simply be doing God's will, wouldn't we? But I want you to notice David will not accept that logic. He knows as well as Abishai that one day he will be king. He knows that that's his rightful office. But that is no excuse for murder. Just because he's engaged in a political struggle and feels sure that God supports his final goal, it doesn't mean that David can rely on God's support for every conceivable means of achieving that goal. No, God must engineer Saul's departure, not David. God must find the means, not David. So important for us to appreciate that. For the devil has been doing his utmost in recent history to popularize this dictum, the end justifies the means, doesn't he? Seems so plausible. You have a goal. Yes, it's a good goal. You want to build a kingdom of justice and freedom and peace. Oh, but how? Look, there's an easy way. Violence. That's what you need. It works. Oh, sure, it's corrupted others, but it won't corrupt you because they didn't have your high ideals and your moral integrity. Make a violent bid for power. Oh, a few may perish on the way up, but that's small loss. Think of all the good you'll be able to do once you're in control. You can have all the authority God wants you to have in no time at all if only you'll compromise on your methods. The end justifies the means. It's the creed of modern political pragmatism, isn't it? It's the epitaph of millions. And it is a lie. It's a lie from the Prince of Lies. The end justifies the means is rubbish. Be sure of this, in this world, it is the means which determine the end every time. You cannot achieve a divine goal by demonic methods. The universe isn't built that way. Our deeds create our destinies. Whatever a man sows, that he reaps. The devil has been so active to persuade us this is not so. He assured us a few decades ago that the quickest way to build world peace was to fight wars. He convinced a sizable proportion of the world the only way to create a classless society is by making people more and more class conscious. He says you can make a just society by legalizing theft, a free society by locking up people. But in every case, he succeeded in blinding men to the brazen contradictions implicit in all these propositions by the magic phrase, the end justifies the means. But it is not so. Jesus answered this lie when the devil put it to him in the wilderness of temptation. All the power of the kingdoms of the world will be yours.
If only you'll bow down and worship me. Compromise your methods, Jesus. Away, Satan, he said. It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. The only way to build the kingdom of God is to make God king. The devil is a treacherous ally. Many a great man has set out to build New Jerusalem, but by being tempted by the violent way to achieve his end, has finished up building Babel instead. David learned that. Thank God he learned it. The fact that David had opportunity to seize the crown by violence, the fact that David had the courage to seize the crown by violence, the fact that God intended to give David the crown anyway, all